Thank you, Jono and others. It's great to be here, and we will be talking about mission from Joshua chapter 4. In Joshua chapter 3, we find God's people, the children of Israel, camped on the banks of the Jordan River. They have a clear mission from God to take the promised land, but there's a huge obstacle between them and fulfilling that mission, the flooded Jordan River. Their leader Joshua tells them they need to trust God and let him take care of this obstacle, as he's done so many times in their history. In chapter 3, verse 9, we read, "Come and listen to what the Lord your God says. Today you will know that the living God is among you. Look, the Ark of the Covenant, which belongs to the Lord of the whole earth, will lead you across the Jordan River. The priests will carry the Ark of the Lord. As soon as their feet touch the water, the flow of water will be cut off upstream and the river will stand up like a wall." So that's what they do, and that's what happens. And chapter 3 concludes with these words. "Meanwhile, the priests who were carrying the Ark of the Lord's Covenant stood on dry ground in the middle of the riverbed as the people passed by. They waited there until the whole nation of Israel had crossed the Jordan on dry ground." Now, the results of this miracle are tremendous. After the crossing, we read, "When all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and all the Canaanite kings who lived along the Mediterranean coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan River so the people of Israel could cross, they lost heart and were paralyzed with fear because of them." So you expect that the children of Israel, armed as they were for battle, confident from what God had done, would plunge headlong into that mission, into battle, into taking that land from those terrified Canaanites. But in actual fact, that's not what happened. The verses I just read come from chapter 5. I skipped over a whole chapter because there's a pause in their progress. In fact, a pause in their progress between chapter 3 and chapter 6. A pause that was necessary for them and is included in the Bible because it's helpful for us. There are lessons for us. Even here today in Sydney that's restricted by COVID pandemic restrictions, these press pause on many good plans. And yet I think God has a message for us.
It seems, if we look at chapter 4, that God doesn't want the children of Israel to just quickly get past the obstacle and dive right into his mission for them. And in chapters 4 and 5, God has the children of Israel stop on the opposite bank of the Jordan. It doesn't look like progress. If you had popped a little GPS tracker on the Ark of the Covenant, it just stands still for days. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't move forward, even though Jericho, the walled city, the city that they're going to take in chapter 6 is right there looking at them on the horizon. And why is this part recorded in such detail? And Peter and I want to say to you today that it's a reminder to us that even in the stillness, God is still moving. When God involves us in his mission, it's never just functional. It's not just about a job he wants us to do, because frankly, God could get the job done far more efficiently and effectively without us. But when God involves us in his mission, it's always formational. As we join him in his mission, he does at least as much in us, shaping and changing us, as he does through us. And that's what chapters 4 and 5 of the book of Joshua are all about. And we want to tell you today that's what our testimony of our involvement in cross-cultural mission, both on the front lines in Central Asia and as we continue to serve in leadership and support roles here in Australia, that's what we've learned. God's mission is never just functional. It's also always formational.
So if you have your Bibles, you can look at Joshua chapter 4, those verses that Erica read so well earlier. As we look at this chapter, we'll be investigating these lessons, reflecting on how they can be applied in our own lives and mission. So I'm not going to read all the verses, but you'd see earlier from verse 4 that Joshua gave this instruction take 12 stones from the very place where the priests are standing in the middle of the Jordan. Carry them out and pile them up at the place where you'll camp tonight. Here, the Israelites had got to the other side of the Jordan, but God doesn't tell them to do any of the things you might expect. He doesn't say, "Ah, celebrate." He doesn't say, "Well done. You've done this, you've got across." He doesn't even say, "Okay, take time and set up your camp now." Instead, at God's instruction, Joshua sends representatives from each tribe back into the river to pick up large stones and bring them back out to make a memorial. See, these stones are to be a reminder of the events they've just experienced. I imagine that heading back into the river to pick up stones was the last thing the leaders of these tribes wanted to do. Most likely they just wanted to put the river behind them with the walls of water that could quickly flood back in. At the very least, they probably wanted to get on with making camp and getting set up for the night and having a rest. But God didn't want them to rush headlong into the conquest of the promised land. He wants them to stay with their River Jordan experience a little longer. And those stones that would have been heavy, he wanted them to take them on their shoulders, pick them up from that place and carry them. What did he have in mind through this instruction?
The truth is that experience by itself is rarely a good teacher. One of our friends and leadership mentors talks about the difference between people who have 10 years' experience and people who've had 1 year's experience 10 times over. There are some people who just don't really seem to learn from what they go through, aren't there? And I think we can all think of moments when that's been our experience too. But if you really want to learn from your experiences, you usually have to take time to stop, to think about it. You need to reflect on and evaluate your experiences in order to discern what are the lessons that you can learn and what are the pathways to growth through them. And I think it's really significant precisely what stones and how Joshua told the people to pick them up. The stones weren't any old stones. They weren't just the stones lying around on the edge of the river. The leaders had to go right back into the middle of the river, right to the heart of that experience, to the place of anxiety and uncertainty and danger, and pick up stones there. And God has lessons for us that come right from the middle of our most challenging experiences. To be even more specific, Joshua tells the leaders to go and take the stones right from in front of the Ark of the Covenant that represented God's presence with us. Because the more memorial that they were to construct with those stones was to remind them of how God had been with them in the middle of the river and how it was, he was the one who had made a path for them through the river, not around it or over it or under it, as my kids' favourite children's book said. They couldn't go around or over or under, they had to go through it. And those were the stones that God wanted them to pick up.
Reflecting on our mission experience, I would have much preferred to skip over the 2 years of focused language learning that was required to become conversant in a Central Asian language. Why doesn't God just give missionaries the gift of tongues so they can get stuck straight into the real work of missionary and mission and communicating the gospel? We heard that question in our own times of impatience, but also from others that we recruited to come and we helped through that experience on the field. And we told them and ourselves that language learning is relationship building, and this is ministry. The main way we learned the languages of Central Asia was the way a child learns language. We immersed ourselves by living with a non-English speaking local family. We did a lot of watching and listening. And then we tried to speak, making many mistakes and being corrected. We felt like children, not like missionaries. We experienced great care from these people, as well as correction. We had truths and insights that we wanted to share, but we couldn't get it out in a way that could be understood. And it's not just that we couldn't speak clearly, but we felt tired. We felt defeated as we retreated to our room to watch a DVD, or even, yeah, I guess rather than sitting longer with them, drinking tea, sitting there thinking of powerful stories that we could say, but not clearly able to express them. We spent a lot of time with that family and with neighbours, but we didn't really feel like we were doing our job. It could feel like I was making more progress when I went back into the room and wrote out sentences in my notebook or learnt vocabulary cards. But in learning a language from the people who speak it, not just in a book or a classroom, it's much more than the vocabulary and grammar. As we interacted, we learned about their worldview. And that in itself would change the way we went about our mission. Instead of taking that approach that might be more natural to us, the stories or tools that we'd used confidently in other occasions in the past, we saw them as people and understood something of their heart needs. We heard something more of their spiritual questions. And that informed the way that we were later able to communicate. We also learned a lot about ourselves in that process. How much of our identity and self-worth is tied up in what we can do competently, productively, successfully. 2 years of accomplishing very little other than making people laugh at our mistakes is humbling. God had us stay there for a reason, and he met us in that time. We learned to trust him, because turning hearts to him is ultimately his work, not ours. And we prayed for that fervently with many words, even though we couldn't speak many words to accomplish it, we felt. We also learned that mission is as much about his work in us as it is his work through us. And as he transforms us, not just transforms nations. And these lessons held us in good stead for what would happen in the future.
If you go back into the passage, into Joshua 4, and pick the story up at verse 19, it's really fascinating to see what God asked the children of Israel to do with the stones that they'd picked up and carried out of the river. Verse 19 tells us that at Gilgal, that first place that they camped for the night, Joshua took the stones and piled up the 12 stones, 12 stones representing the 12 tribes. Every part of the nation of Israel had experienced that. And he told the children of Israel that in the future, your children will ask you, what do these stones mean? And you can tell them about your experiences. But not just so that they would know, but Joshua goes on and tells the children of Israel that God did this so all the nations of the earth might know that the Lord's hand is powerful and that you might fear the Lord forever. This experience of a miraculous crossing wasn't the first time the children of Israel had experienced that, was it? But the Red Sea experience was long ago and far away, and pretty much everybody who'd experienced that firsthand had died and were no longer with them to tell the story. And so God gave this generation their own experience of his miraculous overcoming of an obstacle, but he wanted them to have a concrete reminder. And that's what the stones were. They were used to be a memorial to help the children of Israel fix those events in their memory so that they wouldn't be forgotten. And by doing that, their impact could be multiplied. Every time you walk past the stones, it wasn't just the people who experienced those events that were reminded, but other people, they were a marker for the future generations, other people who saw the stones and asked about them. And those stories spread out, not just through the generations of Israel, but out from Israel, as God had said, to touch nations around the world.
After September 11, 2001, the government of the republic where we were working started to control religion more tightly. On Christmas Eve 2002, the community development organisation we were working with notified us that the secret police had begun to target an investigation on our team in the town where we were working, which we were the only longer-term team working in community development there from the West. We realised that we might only have months left in the country, depending on the result of that investigation and what happened. We'd planned to spend those days from Christmas to New Year having fun together, but instead we spent them sorting and destroying or burning sensitive papers and wrestling with uncertainty and fear as we waited for more news. What was God doing here? We felt so limited, and our initial focus was on what we couldn't do. How could we do his mission when we were being so closely watched, when we couldn't go out and gather together with our friends who were local believers in this nascent house church in that place? But as we took our uncertainty and questions to God at that time and over many weeks, we began to ask, what can we do? What should be our focus? And something shifted in us. We wanted to help gather and teach believers, but when the surveillance ramped up, we realised that that could bring more unwelcome pressure on them, which was the last thing we wanted. As we looked to God, we were reminded that it was the church that was going to remain, not us, not our organisation. The local believers, the churches that they would plant, are the children, those future generations that would ask about the stones that were stacked up and hear stories long after we were gone from that place. So while we continued to work faithfully in our public community development roles, behind the scenes, we changed the way we invested in believers and even the urgency with which we did that. We discipled individual leaders. Sometimes they'd come into our home, or we would go into their home or another secluded place where we could gather. They were the ones that would run the gatherings or the church meetings. We tried to make every lesson we did with the individual reproducible, both in the content and in the way that we taught, so that they could naturally understand it and naturally carry on and reproduce that. We treated these individuals as leaders even before they saw that in themselves, and many of them are still following the Lord and leading the house churches today. It was great to see and hear in that video that we saw that people, locals from many different churches and places, singing the blessing together. It reminds and encourages us that God's work continues today. And at the end of that video, it said you wouldn't understand the language, what was written in the local language, but it said, you thought the church was dead, but it is alive. And that's that confident statement that God is winning the victory. God is doing that work.
We said that this story started at Christmas 2002. In fact, it took till the middle of 2006 before the government closed dozens of the non-government organisations, and which had been the way that many Christian workers had accessed the country and needed to leave. And in many ways, those years felt like standing in the middle of the river with the water piled up, you know, just waiting for it to come back. In God's providence, you know, the one team that didn't get closed down even in 2006, it was the team translating the Bible into the local language. And to this day, I don't know how they managed to fly under the radar. But God kept key team members in the country for another 5 years, long enough to get the translation of the scriptures to a point where it could be continued outside the country. And they now have the whole Bible in country and actually on their phones. We've got it on our phones. Much easier to have it as an app on your phone, because you can just delete it if the secret police come knocking. Because that was the most crucial thing, the most crucial memorial stone that the people needed to remember who God was and what he'd done. It wasn't us. It was his word. And during that time and through those limitations, God was at work in all those ways that we've shared, but he was also at work in us. I think seeing God's faithfulness, keeping us there just long enough to build a church that didn't depend on foreigners, helped us when we went on to the next country and faced similar challenges there. In 2007, so we've gone 2002, 2007, the community development organisation we worked for in our next country was investigated by no less than six government departments in under a year. We had a court case, we had all our visas revoked and miraculously reinstated, and Peter and I were really young leaders, one of us in our late 20s, one of us in our early 30s. But what has got us through that time was going back to our memorial stones, remembering all the ways that God had shown us in the past that he was with us and he was acting for us in our journey up to that point. And that helped us to persevere until, you know, for another 5 years, 6 years, until God revealed that it was time for us to leave. But these stories and this work multiplies to others and to others also as it goes on.
The last application point from the passage in Joshua 4 is how the priests as leaders had to stay still, and yet God was helping them in the process. You see, a constant question we wrestle with during our time in Central Asia, and we still wrestle with in our leadership roles now in mission, is what we're meant to do. What's the leader's role in these times? And here too, I think the experience of the children of Israel can help us. Have a look at verse 10 and the role that the priests play in this story. Verse 10 says, "The priests who were carrying the ark stood in the middle of the river until all of the Lord's commands that Moses had given to Joshua were carried out. Meanwhile, the people hurried across the riverbed. And when everyone was safely on the other side, the priests crossed over with the ark of the Lord as the people watched." The priests were the first onto the Jordan. They had to step out in faith and take those first terrifying steps into the flooded river. Once they were in the middle of the river, they had to remain standing there. That's what they're doing from 3 verse 17 through to 4 verse 17, just standing still in the middle of the river. But they're doing something vital. The priests hold the Ark of the Covenant, the symbol of God's presence with his people. They hold it as they would have on rods on their shoulders. And they stayed there right in the middle of the river until every last person had made it safely to the other side. But not just till the people had made it across to safety, if you like. Even beyond that, they stayed there while representatives from those 12 tribes were chosen by Joshua. And those representatives were sent back right to where the priests remained standing to choose and select these rocks, put them on their shoulders, carry them out, as we've heard. That's a lot of obedient waiting until, as it said, the Lord's commands had been carried out. And that's the call of leadership. They had to stand fast in faith. They had to persevere in faith. It's not particularly dramatic or a glamorous job, but it's a vital job. When faced with barriers to our mission, we need leaders who are prepared to step out in faith, to lead by example, to serve by carrying some of the load, to help us see God's presence among us, and to stay right in the middle of the anxious, confusion, uncertain or uncomfortable situation. To stay there long enough for the whole community to make it safely through the experience, but more so to learn from that experience.
Peter's currently serving as a leader at our church and at Morling College where he works, and on the board of AMT, which is the missions arm of the CC Ost family of churches that we belong to. And I'm currently in a leadership role with OM, a mission agency that I work for. And this pandemic is causing all kinds of disruption and challenges for every one of those ministries and for us in our leadership roles in them. And the longer it goes on, the more it feels like something we just want to get through so we can get on with the mission that God has given us. I think the way we get through might have changed a bit. You know, in the first lockdown last year, we were constantly wondering how long until things can get back to normal. Now I just want it to be over so we can get to some kind of new normal on the other side. But who knows where that will be? And it's a constant challenge to think, how do I lead here in the middle of it? Right now, my team's trying to do something as ordinary and simple as make our plans and our budgets for next year, but it's ridiculously complicated because we don't know, can we travel? How can we travel? What are vaccine visas and all those things going to look like? Just this week, I was talking to one of my teammates, Iris, and her conversation struck me deeply and reminded me of some things in this passage from Joshua. She'd been in a meeting where they were talking about how do we bring our pastoral care and our spiritual formation together, even in this season. We've got two different teams working on things. Where's the overlap? How do we work together? And Iris said to me, you know what, we had this great conversation. We sat there and we talked about it for an hour. There were so many questions, but at the end of it, we realised we just have questions. We don't have any answers. And she said, you know, as I'm thinking about it, I feel like that's actually a good thing, just to stay with the questions, just to be in the confusion, because that's where God can work. And I think what I'm learning in this season is that my role is often just to stay present in the middle of the confusion or the discomfort or the anxiety of this season, and to hold up the Ark of the Covenant, as it were, to keep pointing people to the truth that God is with us and that God is the one who is making a way through it, and that we just need to stand there, stand in that space long enough to see him work and long enough to gather up all those lessons that he has to teach us for the future.
Can you relate to that too, amid this COVID pandemic? I have to confess to many moments when I just wish I could race through and we'd be in a stage where students are back at school and people are together back in church and all the ministries are able to resume what they were doing before. That when I turned on the news, it wouldn't be seeing COVID numbers and a focus on that. And yet, this passage of scripture challenges me to not rush ahead, because if I do, I might miss part of the work that God wants to do in me and in our community. And we're part of that preparation as God works in us. He will then work through us in the next season, and maybe in a different way, not just for the sake of getting through this, but for the sake of his mission being done in his way and having that lasting effect. God's given all of us a mission. You've been hearing about different aspects of mission here at King's Park over recent weeks. And we know that individually and as a body, we're to show and tell the world who he is and what he's done for us. And yes, there are challenges and obstacles to doing that, especially amidst a lockdown. As we sit in this space, I do want to encourage us to think about what we can do and to focus on God, each of us individually as well as together as a body of Christ. The God who knows what's ahead, the God who knows what's inside, and the God who will lead us, who is leading us through this and causing us to grow through this. And part of that is reflecting. So I've got three questions for us to reflect on in this season. Firstly, how are we experiencing God's presence with us? Well, what's he showing us that we wouldn't have experienced otherwise about himself? Secondly, what's God doing in us? How's he shaping and changing me in this process, or us? And thirdly, how will this experience change the way we do his mission in the future? Our answers to those questions may be the rocks that we take from this time and use to build a memorial that will fix these experiences in our memories and indeed in changed hearts, so that as he continues to impact us, we will continue to impact those around us as we move forward in the mission God's given us. Thanks.